Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host for the next 45 minutes. This is another in our ongoing series, The Week in Reviews, a chance to sit down one-on-one with a mover and shaker in the entertainment world. My guest today is East Coast-based singer and songwriter Tokio Rosenthal. Tokio has just released a new single, one that has an uncanny timeliness about it. As the press release says, it's not about 1929, it's about 2009. Before I introduce Tokio, let's hear this new single. This is The Great Depression. Tokio, it's great to have you back on the show.
Oh, it's great to be back, as always.
I really like that single, The Great Depression. It's such an appropriate song for the current economic climate. What sort of feedback are you getting about it?
Well, everybody who hears it is pretty much reacting the way you are on several levels. One, you know, they like it musically, and I could say that I got to take my hat off to my producer Chris Stamey, who did a great job putting the record together, and a fantastic fiddle of Bobby Britt too on there. But from the theme of it, it seems for me possibly fortunately, but for the rest of the world unfortunately, it becomes more and more relevant every day. It seems, you know, when Obama became president, I think we all thought there'd be some sort of like great quick fix for the economic strife around the world, and yet every drawer that he seems to open up seems to bring more distress. And so it's every day the song is becoming more and more relevant.
Indeed. When did you actually pen this song? And was it directly aimed at the current economic crisis, or was it just happenstance?
No, it was definitely aimed at the present crisis, but let's see, right now we're in February. I wrote it probably a little while after I think Obama was elected, or, you know, might have been like halfway finished around the time of the election or so. So it wasn't written, you know, since the inauguration or anything like that. It was kind of Bush was still in the White House while it was written, let's put it that way.
So it really does have a timeliness, and it's not very old, shall we say.
No. It was the sort of thing, if you were, you know, most baby boomers, and I put myself in that category, grew up hearing about the Great Depression that began in 1929 and ran almost to World War II. You know, here are our grandparents spinning tales. Anybody that we ran into that lived through that era always talked about, well, back in the Depression this and back in the Depression that, and things cost a nickel and nobody had jobs and there were people selling apples on street corners. And I always found it incredibly fascinating to hear these stories. I found it scary, you know, especially when you're a young kid, you're hearing these stories. And yet they were always sort of ended with, this could never happen again. You know, we put safeguards in the government, and FDR came in, and he was our savior, and, you know, they would talk about the fireside chats and everything else that went along during that era. So I grew up thinking it could never happen again, and yet here we are, and it's happening, on a you know, an exponential scale at this point, and you kind of find that, you know, you're looking at these people and they're telling you that the recession, it took them 2 years to admit that we were in a recession. And that's why I call this a depression, because I think it'll take them another 3 years to admit that we're in a depression.
Right. I think I agree with you. Are you getting any airplay out of it?
Yes, but it's sort of following the typical Tokyo Rosenthal pattern, which is I'm getting more airplay in Europe at the moment, and which is where I continue, you know, my career seems to do better over there musically. It's hard in this country right now. We've put the song out as a single, and this isn't the old days where you walked into, when I was a little kid, we had a Sam Goody's within walking distance of my house, and I'd walk over to Sam Goody's and buy the newest Beatle record, and it would be a little 45 and a sleeve, and I'd buy a single. You put out a single today, it's virtually impossible to market it. People, the only way you could get this song right now is by downloading it. It's available, you know, through the traditional downloading means. You can get it on iTunes, go to Tokyo Rosenthal or Mr. Tell Me About the Great Depression, and it's there, and it's on CD Baby and Amazon and everybody else. You could download it. But there's no store to walk into and buy a hard copy of Mr. Tell Me About the Great Depression. It will be on a new album that's coming out around Christmas time. But we put it out as a single because of its relevancy and to make a statement and to make some noise. But that also leads to a situation where the rest of the world is in this heavy download mode, as I'm sure you're aware of from a music point of view. Mm-hmm. So we sent it to DJs throughout the United States as a download. without hard copies, just to see, like, are they in sync with the rest of the world? Will they download it off an email that we send to them and then play it on the air? So this all has been taking place just over the last couple of weeks. So it's going to be curious to see if the airplay picks up in the States, or if, in fact, we'll have to press 1,000 hard copies and send them to all the DJs.
Right. It seems to me that to have a successful single, you need two things going for you. Number one, you got to have a great song, which this certainly is, and just a teensy weensy little bit of luck getting it into the right eardrums.
Well, you're 100% right, and thank you for the compliments on the track. So, assuming that part one is correct, it's getting that door open. For instance, I know that my publicity people from the record label, from Rock and Sock Records, have been talking to CNBC. Which is obviously not a radio station, that's a television network, but it's a TV
right.
network that is all about the economy and the stock market 24/7. And trying to get them to somehow, use it in a promotional way or manner, which would be nice for us. Our publicists also are trying to talk to, unfortunately, I don't want to exploit distressed markets, but this is a song that should be being played in Michigan, for instance, where people are losing their jobs, in the auto industry. I don't want it to become too much of a rallying cry for them, but it's sort of like Buddy, Can You Spare a Dime?
Right.
From the Depression, and that was sort of like a rallying cry or an anthem of that era, and. I don't think this is a song that leaves no hope for the future. It's kind of, actually, I look at it as a futuristic type of song, where it's somebody, a young boy sitting on a doorstep someplace talking to this old man saying, "Mister, tell me about the Great Depression of hopefully just 2009. But he may say, "Hey, what was it like from 2009 to 2029? We don't know.
Right.
We don't know what the future is going to bring, but it's certainly a futuristic song.
I think this would transition so nicely into a great music video, but I'm guessing the economics of doing a project like that would be prohibitive. But I could really see this on a channel like CMT. It just seems to fit their exact needs.
Oh, I've got a video background, so I hear you 100%, and I see it. I see the video in my mind. I would love to have Michael Moore produce it or somebody like that. But yes, the economics are somewhat prohibitive. I think what we're planning on doing is what we had done with "Love One Out" from my last CD, is make a YouTube video, possibly with nothing more than the lyrics and the music. And just put it out there and let people read the lyrics and hear the song, and that seemed to work quite well with "Love One Out," where we got several thousand people went to the YouTube version of it. So maybe it'll work just as well here, and help on the promotional level.
That's a very good idea, actually, because you can put something together on a shoestring budget. I do think, though, that If you were going to take the YouTube route, you should at least sort of include some still photos of the, quote, Great Depression. I can see the video in my own mind as well.
Yeah. There was just to digress for a second, I remember when I was a kid and studying the Depression in junior high school, there was this one picture of a luncheonette window, and it had nothing but the menu written on the window of what was inside, they were selling inside, and the prices. And I always had this class right before lunch, and it was things like, pork chops and beans, 5 cents. And it was like, I just have this picture in my head, and it'll never go away. I could almost recite the menu by memory. It was incredible.
I love the mix of instruments on the track. The use of the fiddle is just such a great addition. It really gives a whole different dimension to the song. And I know you'll likely disagree, but I find it vaguely Charlie Daniels in style.
I don't disagree that much. I think Charlie Daniels put out some great music and didn't get a lot of, you know, he was looked at more as a pop artist, and I think he didn't get a lot of the respect he deserved. He's a very stylistic and good fiddle player. This fiddle player's name is Bobby Britt. Mm. He's all of, I believe, 25 years old.
No way.
He's a fiddle prodigy. And it's a great story. What happened was he's played now on my first two albums and now on the single, and I'm sure he'll be on more for the upcoming album. When I was recording my first album, One Score and Ten, at Chris Stamey's studio, there was one track that I wanted fiddle on. And I asked Chris, I said, you know, and I had just recently moved to North Carolina at that point, and I said, you know, who do you know down here that can play fiddle? Should I be hot calling this guy or that guy? And he says, well, before you do anything, there's a kid who lives right across the street. I said, really? And he says, yeah. He says, let me see if I can book him. He says, you know, and if it doesn't work out, you know, then we'll bring somebody else in. He says, but he's really good. I think you're going to like him. So the next session, I get there, and sure enough, this kid comes walking across the street with his fiddle case, comes in, he's big, tall. He's about 6'3", 6'4", and takes out the fiddle, and it was like he was inside my head, Simon. He just went out there, and he nailed it. That was on a song called track number 2 on the first album. I'll get back to the title of it later. Anyway, he was just fantastic. And he just like blew me away, and I said, wow, you know, I've got to think about him for the next album. And on the next album, of course, he was on I Care If You Do,
mm-hmm.
and we planted seeds. And What's So Bad About Being Misunderstood was the track I'm thinking of from the first album.
Right.
And just a tremendous fiddle player, just instinctively, you know, just knows, took to this song, like you said, it made the record for me.
Oh, without doubt. Who else is playing on the track?
Well, Chris Stamey played bass,
mm-hmm.
and of course everybody knows Chris. He's a world-class bass player. He was, of course, a star in his own right when he was with the DBs in the 80s and had a good solo career. He's just a fantastic engineer and producer, and he played bass on this. And I'm somewhat reluctant to say I played everything else on the album. on the track, I played all the guitars, electric guitar, acoustic guitar. I played drums, organ, and piano, and mandolin.
Wow. The last time we spoke, your CD Love One Out was getting a lot of buzz in Europe and Japan. Has that buzz continued?
I'm happy to say it has. It led to me going back to both the UK, Holland, and into Belgium about a month ago. I was over there, and I made 14 appearances in 10 days, and a lot of it was on. They do their radio shows over there, especially in Holland, are quite unique. They have a lot of live concerts with live audiences that are done, you know, obviously live on the radio, where you go in and we go in and do a one-hour concert, and, you know, a big part of the country would hear it, and it's a great way to both promote your records and hit your fans, and you're reaching thousands of people at once, because obviously I'm not a stadium act, so I'm not playing to 60,000 people when I do a live show. I'm playing club-sized venues, you know, under 1,000 people for sure. And this was a great tour, and then I got to play Scotland as well, and played Edinburgh, and did some radio on over there as well. The album continues to get really good reviews, and I think after I did the last time we chatted and visited, I did a tour in the States as well, down to Texas, and did a Northeast tour in New York and Boston, Woodstock, and now, based on this last tour, I've been asked to go back there. I'm doing a spot gig in Hamburg, Germany in March.
And I was absolutely amazed. I was looking through the where you're playing list, and I was thinking to myself, where's the economics in this? You know, he's going to fly to Hamburg for one show.
I wish I could tell you that the economics were good and that it was really paying off great. I'm not destitute, but it's part of what you have to do to break in these days and to market properly. And then I'm going back to Holland, Belgium, and back to the UK beginning April 23rd.
Wow. Also, the last time we talked, we spoke about the horrible state of the American music industry and the problems facing even well-known musicians like yourself. Has that big label come knocking at your door yet?
I can't say the big label has. I've got several feelers that we're negotiating with right now that want to... I'm on a label called Rock and Sock Records, which is about as small an indie as you can possibly get on.
Right.
And they'd be very... You know, they just don't have the wherewithal to do certain things. And a lot of these other labels have come talking to them about taking over my catalog and putting out the next album. And we're in those conversations now. And I hope they come to fruition, as long as it's somebody that can, you know, do things for me that aren't getting done now.
Right. There's two sides to that coin, though. I've interviewed a number of incredibly well-known stars from the 70s and 80s, and a couple of them have said that they made mistakes by changing labels, by, you know, going to the big boys. The big boys seem to offer a lot, but they were Indian givers. You know, they give with one hand and take away with the other.
Well, the basic of the industry has changed 180 degrees in the last 10 years. It used to be that you toured to sell records. And
right.
Now you give away the record to tour and make the money that way. So the record label, while it's a necessary evil, a lot of times all they can really deliver is retail distribution. And the fact is there's not that much retail sales going on. It's a lot of it's done on the Internet. What I'd be looking for is what they call a 360-degree deal, which is a record label that comes and puts together your tours as well and helps you in that aspect. And if they can bring the right thing to the table, fine. And if they don't, then I'll continue on as I am. But an interesting side note, in you talk about the bigger acts having trouble, the album of the year from the Grammys this year was Raising Sand with Alison Krauss and Robert Plant.
Mm-hmm.
Now, normally, the day after or the week after that you get this great award, your album continues to sail through the charts and do tremendous sales. They've sold all of 70,000 CDs since winning.
Oh, my
Grammys.
Goodness.
Now, to me, 70,000 sales would be fantastic. Mm-hmm. But put it into perspective, they just got the Grammy for Record of the Year. That you know, in the old days, that would mean 500,000 sales.
Oh,
a million extra. And they sold 70,000 CDs.
Wow.
So it's a very fragmented and segmented market right now, and it may continue that way. I mean, I'd love to see some major, you know, to me, I love the majors from the old days because I grew up with them. I'd love to see like a Warner's come out and Sony with a game plan for a $5 CD to get everybody off the downloads and back into the stores buying CDs with liner notes and pictures and little booklets and everything else that goes with it. Because I find downloads very impersonal.
Oh, I totally agree. I mean, I'm a reviewer, and nothing turns me off more than just having a digital download. I like to look at the cover art. I like to read the liner notes. You know? It's all part of the excitement.
And for me as a musician, it's part of the process too. I mean, I like working on my album cover. I like the, you know, shooting the picture for the back of it. I like putting, you know, the thank yous and everything else. It's part of the process, and it's a fun part.
Right. Let's take a musical break here. and play a track from your album Love One Out. This is what I think is a very, very pretty little song, and one that I know there's a great story behind. This is Little Poetry Girl. Girl, as I understand, it's about your daughter.
Well, yeah, I've been blessed with having two great daughters. My oldest daughter, though, was a award-winning poet. And what happens a lot of times, you know, when you're a kid, you get into one thing, and your parents love what you're into, and tend to think that's what you're going to be doing the rest of your life. My father wanted me to be a pro bowler. So, because that's something I happened to be good at when I was young also. So put that into perspective. But here she was, this fantastic writer, winning all kinds of medals and everything, and then just stopped writing and went on to other things. I mean, I don't want to make it sound like she stopped writing and didn't do anything worthwhile. She stopped writing to do her PhD dissertation, and she's in law school right now and at NYU, so she's doing productive things with her mind. But But I always felt like, oh, boy, I just wanted her to keep writing and writing, especially as a songwriter. It was like, well, maybe I'd start using some of her lyrics or something. This song is somewhat of a plea, a little bit tongue in cheek maybe, to coerce her into writing again, and she is in fact a little poetry girl.
Does she write at all, or
if she does, she's not letting me know about it. There's a song on my first album called "Too Late for Me, Carolina," and I was about halfway through the song and struggling on the lyrics, I came across in a folder that I'd put in one of her poems in a folder of my lyrics when we were packing up to move to North Carolina. And I just happened to pull it out, and I started looking at some of these lines, and I said, wow, these are really good lines. They could really work in this song. So I took the lines, and if you look on the album, my daughter is co-credited with writing Too Late for Me, Carolina, because I took about six of her lines out of the poem. And she came to hear me perform it one night, and I hadn't told her about it, and I played this song, and I said, recognize those lyrics? And she gave me that look, and she says, well, they sounded vaguely familiar. I said, you wrote them. And she goes, really? And I had a reminder about the poem. So I think, you know, I'm going to continue to twist her arm, and I'll get her to write a little bit. But who knows what, you know, I'm sure her writing now as she's gotten older, she's 25 now, so... And, you know, I think it's going to be a lot different than when she was 14, 15, or 16. So it'll be interesting what will come out of her if she does.
Sure. Making a CD is one thing. Selling it is a whole different ball of wax. Airplay clearly is the favored method, but it's becoming increasingly difficult to get. You told me you were embarking on... what I found hugely humorous, your Loretta Lynn car tour, where you were going to go bang on radio station doors. How did that work out?
Well, it worked. First of all, let me say, it's not. I don't show up unannounced, which they sort of did in the movie. If you watched Loretta Lynn, they would drive around. You know, it wasn't really clear whether they were showing up unannounced or not either. But it works great. And it's something that I'm going to continue to employ and will be embarking on even more. I did it over in Europe as well. But it's a great way to get out there. And I don't think a lot of musicians are doing this. And I don't think a lot of them, especially in the Americana genre, realize just how the stations are going to welcome you with open arms. I'm amazed that, because they don't get that many visitors, I guess. Especially in Americana stations are quite often located on college campuses or in smaller towns with very powerful antennas, though, I might add. So it's a great way. And the way those interviews work when you go around to the stations is you go in, they'll block out 20 minutes to a half hour to spend with me, which is really nice. It's like, imagine if you had to buy a half hour commercial on a radio station. You can't get that anyplace. So you walk in, they'll do an interview segment, maybe play a track off my CD, have me play a song live in studio, maybe something new that I'm working on or something, or an acoustic version of something that's electric on the album, and then play another track off the album and plug my website and tell people how to buy the CD, and I get in the car and I drive to the next station. And I love doing it. I mean, I could go out there, I'll hit two or three stations in a day, pull into a hotel, Holiday Inn someplace, get a bucket of fried chicken, watch TV, and get up the next day and do it again.
That's great.
And I enjoy it. I enjoy that as much as I enjoy playing a gig someplace. Because, again, I can reach thousands of people at once, sit there and plug my wares and play a couple of songs acoustically and meet a lot of great time. And if nothing else, you know, Simon, you do a mailing. You put these mailings out, and you send your CDs, your record label sends them out, and the publicists do everything. But you don't know if it's going to get played. You don't know when it's getting played in a lot of cases. Here, you're sitting right there. You know that your record's getting played because you're there in person. And it's just a tremendous way to market. And I just kind of do it segment by segment of the country. We've got another radio car tour planned for the Pacific Northwest coming up. in late spring, and then I'm going to kind of try to crisscross part of Canada because I've got a bit of a following up there too. And
your Edmonton song definitely garnered a great deal of interest in the Canadian marketplace.
Right, you know, and I just like to, you know, follow up on that and keep my name out there. So hit the stations up there as well.
Okay, it's time for an absolute shameless plug. What is your website so that people can come find you?
It's actually quite simple. It's just TokyoRosenthal.com. Tokyo, of course, spelled like the city, TokyoRosenthal.com. If you go there, it gives you all the information. Well, first of all, it's got all the press and the reviews and the radio interviews and everything. My wife did a great job building the website. Thank you very much. And it's also got the links on to where you can buy hard copies of the CDs, download them, download the new single, Mr. Tell Me About the Great Depression. I've got a MySpace site, too, that you can click on and go to. All the typical high-tech things that I don't know how to do, but people have built for me.
So your wife's your internet technical advisor.
She's my webmaster.
Webmaster.
And my Zen master, too. So.
I have a trick question for you. I've asked several other musicians this one, and I've received all sorts of different answers. When you create a new song, do you start with the lyrics or do you start with the music?
I would have to say, for me, it's 95% of the time it's the lyrics. The only time I could tell you on record, to something that I've recorded where it was the opposite, was on the last album. I did a song called Random Noises, and it was one of these times where I just happened to be sitting around, you know, fiddling on the guitar, and sometimes you play and you start to get into some sort of a groove or a riff, and I came up with this riff, and I said, I got this riff, and then I figured out, okay, well, where would this go from here, and then I came up with the next set of chords, and now I had this music and no lyrics, and oddly enough, I don't collaborate a lot with other people. I'd steal the lyrics off my daughter's poem or something like that, but I haven't really collaborated. And there was a DJ from one of the car tours that I had done earlier on, great girl named Becky Duval, and from Wilkesboro, North Carolina. And after we had done the radio show segment, Becky told me that she wrote poetry and wrote some stuff. And she wasn't pitching me to use her stuff. This was just general conversation, said she liked to do it and found it therapeutic. And I said to her, I said, well, send me some stuff. I said, I'm always looking for lyrics. Never thinking that she would do that. You have those conversations every day with people and they don't follow up. And next thing I know, email, I get like six poems from Becky. And they're pretty dark stuff. I'm saying, oh, wow, Becky's more troubled than I thought she was. And I could say that because we kid about it. So I'm looking at these poems. I go, well, this is pretty dark stuff. And okay, well, I'm going to store it over here and see maybe I can come up with that stuff. I thought my stuff was sad, but this was pretty sad music. And so now I had this riff. And oddly enough, and uncharacteristically, I'd written the music first. And I said, well, maybe I'll go look at Becky's lyrics. Maybe I can make her lyrics fit into this song. And I did. So if you notice on the Love One Out album, she's credited with writing the lyrics for Random Noises. Well, that was probably the only time, though, that I've written the music first and then added lyrics later on.
I can't remember who it was. I think it might have been Ken Hensley, who I was talking to. And his response to that question was, I always write the lyrics. The music just follows automatically.
I wish it was that automatic and that easy. Sometimes you're sitting there with lyrics and you're trying to, you know, you wrote them thinking one thing musically and they come out totally different. You wind up just writing a totally different song. I think, you know, Love One Out, the actual single itself, was sort of like that, where I'm writing a pro-gay marriage song, which you would think would be a ballad, and it wound up being a cross between Bonnie Raitt and the Allman Brothers. you know, it's a hard rocker. So it's, you know, you never know what's going to happen when you ride them.
Right. Alas, our time once again is rapidly running to an end. So what I would like to do is say thank you very much, Tokyo, and I'd like to finish the show with another one of your great songs, St. Patrick's Day.
Well, very appropriate with St. Patrick's Day coming up March 17th, not too
absolutely.
Far away.
That was the way I thought it. So, Tokyo, I want to say thank you very much for being my guest today. I wish you good luck on your upcoming European adventures, and I also look forward to your new CD later this year. Maybe?
Later this year, should be out before Christmas. And always a pleasure to be on the show, and thanks for all the support, Simon.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Tokyo. And I'm going to sign off with St. Patrick's Day.
Day. I know what you're doing, I know what you're doing. Prayers in hell your way. I know what you're doing, I know what you're doing. I could feel it here, a thousand miles away. You're self-medicated, but it's too late. Treat you like a kid.
This is Simon Barrett saying thanks for listening to Blogger News, and I really wish Tokyo Rosenthal all the best in the future. Thank you, Toke.